Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast with Sports Pro Editorial Director James Emmett, getting right inside the sports industry and then recording it on audio.
Yes, welcome to another Sports Pro Podcast. Once again here in Sports Pro Surrogate Studio above a pub near Oldgate East with me for this special look through Sports Pro Magazine Dec/Jan 2015/16 edition is Sports Pro Editor Owen Connolly.
Hi, James.
And also a man who needs to turn his phone off, Michael Long.
Evening, James.
Okay, let's get cracking. First things first, Owen, what have you done for us this month?
Well, it's a collective effort, James, as ever. We have in Sports Pro number 83 a special report on sport and social media. We have some content on the evolution of the betting industry, particularly in the delivery and scouting side. We have a look at integrity with the ICSS, who held their Securing Sport event earlier in November. We've got an interview with Mahesh Bhupathi about the International Tennis Premier League.
International Premier Tennis League.
There we go. And we've got some horse sports. The ones that like running really fast and the ones that like jumping over things, both covered.
It's another action-packed issue, as ever, but I think let's begin on something that's at least mildly topical. Michael, this one's for you, but first of all, for all of us, who watched the Davis Cup this weekend?
I certainly did.
Yep, I did.
Okay, great. What a great event.
Yeah, it was a brilliant event. Brilliant. The Belgians put on a good show after everything that went down in Paris, you know, security fears and all that.
And Brussels,
of course. Yeah, great show, and obviously great for British tennis and Andy Murray and the Murray family in particular.
It was a fantastic show, and the Davis Cup is brilliant. Just to see, possibly the BBC coverage was a little too far leaning towards crowd shots, but it is great to see a different sort of atmosphere in tennis. I think everyone agrees. When you've got a stake in it, I suppose, when your country is competing, the Davis Cup is a fantastic event. But could it be better? Question to both of you. Is the Davis Cup running at its optimum?
I mean, Mike is more of an authority on this than I am, so I'll get my thoughts out of the way first and then let him reinforce or undermine them. But the two things I noticed, one was that all the games that Britain have been involved in this year have been real events. I mean, the atmosphere has been fantastic. The two things are, though, the format I can't really quite get my head round with the various world leagues and world groups and so on. It's not clear to the layman why Britain, if they'd been playing Argentina, would have been at home but were away because they were playing Belgium. And there's little dressing things as well. The fact that the players are not wearing national team kits. It's a, you know, obviously there are labyrinthine commercial things to go through to get beyond that. But it is something that you just think if you were watching that, you'd say, that's Davis Cup tennis. That's why Andy Murray is wearing a, you know, red, white and blue top instead of his usual Under Armour gear. So it's that kind of stuff.
I think changes are possibly afoot in the Davis Cup in the coming years with a new president of the ITF, David Hegarty. It is worth saying that, commercially at least, it is sort of working for the ITF. It is, of course, its premier year-round competition. It's, you know, as a rights holder, the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup for women's tennis are the major events. The global TV rights are held by beIN Media Group. They've just done a new sponsorship deal with Betway, and BNP Paribas, the major sponsor, signed on again for another load of years just the other day. Mike, your thoughts. What's up with the Davis Cup, Mike?
It's interesting the point that Owen makes on the format side of things. I mean, the world group and the lower tiers, you know, is difficult to know why, you know, how the teams and the nations are divvied up amongst them. I mean, obviously, Britain were very close to being relegated not too long ago, and now they're here, they are winning it, and that's largely down to the fact that Andy Murray has competed for the last couple of years. I think the major point with the format is the, you know, the best of five format, and you can have one player that plays three matches. And if you like Andy Murray, who's a very, very good player, who's very likely to win those three matches, the nation wins. And it can be a tad deceiving, because without Murray, obviously Britain wouldn't be where it is today. Commercially, obviously, yes, BN Media Group since February, I believe, is marketing the TV rights. I think there's a number of tweaks to the format that could be made to make the make it more saleable, you know, more appealing to broadcasters. I know Hegarty, speaking to our colleague Adam Nelson earlier this year, and he mentioned about having a kind of World Cup style event with eight nations at the end of the year, and you'll go off to one host country, host city, and all play each other. I know, James, you had a you had some ideas a few months ago about the Davis Cup and how international team tennis in general, not just the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup, but...
Well, thanks for the introduction, Mike. Yeah. But my thoughts were... basically, I came up with a blueprint for how international soccer should be played. And I was going to take as my model the Davis Cup, because I think it is not just the premier event under the ITF's umbrella, but the premier event in world sport. I don't think there's anything wrong with the Davis Cup. And I think the model should be taken almost like for like in European soccer. A few years ago, UEFA, I think maybe it was last year, UEFA were reorganizing the way that they were going to run international friendlies between the qualifiers and the tournaments and what have you, and try and inject a little bit of jeopardy into these international friendly games to make them more saleable, as you know, your point with the Davis Cup. And the way they, you know, the thing that they came up with was an incredibly convoluted league system, several different leagues. You know, we can, I mean, I haven't got my head around that, but
speaking of convoluted systems, we'll come on to the IPTL.
Indeed, yeah, that's coming up. But yeah, my idea basically, and it's still up for grabs, whoever's in charge of UEFA after Infantino potentially becomes FIFA president in February, I'm willing to talk to them about this. But essentially, Davis Cup of football, we can call it something else, perhaps the Infantino Cup of football. But you don't play friendly games. You play a series of rubbers, like in the Davis Cup. You play perhaps three rubbers over the course of a UEFA week of football. And you include the men's senior national team, the women's senior national team, and perhaps the under-21s. And that way you're encouraging, you know, youth football and women's football, and it's all hunky-dory.
This sounds a lot like the qualifying format for the Premier 12 baseball tournament.
I couldn't get my head around that last week or whenever it was either. perhaps. Anyway, enough of that. It's obviously UEFA, you've got my details. But Michael, the IPTL...
No, I just wanted to pick up on your point. I think you said that there's nothing wrong with the Davis Cup. And I think as a fan, as a product, and certainly watching this weekend and seeing Murray's, you know, reaction, it clearly means a lot. To win it, the problem they've got is the player commitment, and obviously the players always side with the tours. That's where the money's at, you know.
Above, do you know? Do you know if there's any prize money in the Davis Cup?
I'm not sure. I know there's ranking points, but but the problem is, having, you know, the top players committing year after year. I know Stan Wawrinka and Roger Federer, after the Swiss won it in 2014, they refused to play this year, effectively ruling out Switzerland of a genuine chance of retaining their title. I know Murray has committed to the Japan tie that Great Britain have been drawn in next year, which is obviously great for the competition. But obviously, as much as you call it a team event, it is only a team event in name. You know, it relies on the big players. They are decisive, both on the court and off it, in terms of drawing the fans, you know. So I think there is a problem there with the ITF, you know, Hegarty has got to work out a way with the tours to really ensure that the big names are there, you know. And it's the same for a lot of sports, really, when it comes to the international competitions. Obviously, the commercial tours or clubs, whoever, leagues, whoever it may be, obviously pull the strings in many ways, so... I think that's a big hurdle he's got to overcome. Mm.
Talking about ensuring that the big names are there, that is something that the relatively recent IPTL have done a fairly good job of. How have they managed that, Mike?
Money. Unbelievably. Yes, so you know, payouts.
Hang on, tell us what is the IPTL?
So Chris Kermode from the ATP called it a series of glorified exhibitions, which pretty much sums it up. It's just a big all-singing, all-dancing road show that travels to five, well, it'll be five this year. It was four last year in its inaugural season, Asian cities, and features, you know, many big names, some smaller names, some legends, like your favourite tennis player, James, Mark Philippoussis.
The Pooh.
The Pooh, indeed. So, yes, and there's all kinds of idiosyncrasies with it. You know, it's shorter format, it's made for TV. There's all a kind of convoluted point system. There's happiness power points, which count for double.
Is that a Formula E innovation? Or?
Possibly. So, yeah, there's a number of gimmicks. You know, it's if you've seen any of the action on YouTube, you know, or wherever you might find this action. I'm not sure where you find this action. But it's quite cringeworthy. And, you know, it's, you know, cheerleaders, all sorts of things that you don't see on the tennis tours.
It's called the IPTL. Is it the IPL of tennis?
No, I wouldn't say it is, because I think it lacks genuine sporting credibility, which is one of the criticisms of it, which I think is absolutely fair enough. It's not trying to be a genuine sporting event. You know, it doesn't have ranking points, it has big prize money, but it's in what you would call the off season, although tennis pretty much doesn't have an off season. You know, there's these kind of exhibitions have been going on for years. It's just despite in this month's magazine Bhupati, you know, billing it.
This is Mahesh Bhupati, the chief executective, president, commissioner.
Founder, I believe. So obviously the former doubles tennis player who's very, very, very good at what he does. He runs Globo Sport, a management company. You know, he knows what he's doing. It's made for TV. It's made for an Asian fan base. So, you know, it ticks those boxes. You just get the sense that it's going down the route of the world team tennis, which admittedly has been around for 40 years or something. It was created in the US in the 70s, but it's going to be on the periphery, I think, and it won't ever really be taken seriously just because it's so far removed from what's there currently.
Yeah, I mean, it's made for people really who don't get a chance to see a lot of the biggest stars all playing in the same week at the same tournament.
Federer hadn't played in India until last December.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, the comparison with the IPL, because that is, of course, I mean, that's in that franchise format, at least, it's very much the pinnacle of its sport. It's quite hard to replicate that in other sports because they already have, you know, models that are in place that cater to that need. I don't know, it's an interesting innovation. It might be that in time it creates a base or a stimulus for other ATP events to go to some of these cities.
I think in terms of team tennis in general, obviously we've just been talking about the Davis Cup, and I think if you had somewhere in a property that was somewhere in between the Davis Cup and the IPTL, you'd be getting somewhere. You know, the Davis Cup needs sprucing up and modernising, and the IPTL is maybe a tad too far for the tennis purist. Who
IPTL sounds a bit like Super Mario Tennis with the kind of happiness powerpoints and
exactly.
and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's it. It's an ace for part one. In part two, Owen and Mike interview me on equestrian sport and a little bit of racing, and I interview George Pine and John Collins on hospitality in the NFL.
Sports Pro, the sports industry leader in print, digital, events, and podcasts.
Welcome back to part two. In this part, hopefully, Owen Connolly and Mike Long have some questions for me about a couple of pieces that I wrote for this month's Sports Pro magazine. Michael, you're nodding vigorously. Do you have a question?
I have a question, and it's not so much about the piece itself. It's about your experience in Los Angeles, rubbing shoulders or bumping into A-listers.
Oh, my experience overall. Basically, Mike, as you know, I went over to Los Angeles for a few days in early November. Mm-hmm. And ostensibly, the reason for the trip was I was going to the Longines Masters Los Angeles event. I also managed to fit in a few interviews here and there around town whilst I was there. But I spent 3 days at a four-day event. I missed out the first day, in case you're wondering. The Longines Masters LA event is one of three Longines Masters events, the Longines Masters series. Essentially, these have been running since 2009, but it was only last year. They're show jumping events, by the way, in equestrian sport. It was only last...
Sanctioned by the FEI.
Exactly. It was only last year that they were sanctioned by the FEI, the global governing body of equestrian sport. Basically, they're set up to be the grand slam of show jumping. And this is very self-conscious sort of branding. They're taking the Grand Slam tennis tournaments as their model, although there's only three of these events. They're run by a Belgian company called EEM. A Belgian company that is fairly besotted with Roland Garros in particular. So when they say Grand Slam of equestrian events, they really mean the Roland Garros of equestrian events. Now, they are glitzy and glamorous. This one in LA took place over 4 days in the LA Convention Center. It's a gigantic building right next to the Staples Center in LA and LA Live in downtown. It's a gigantic hall with horse footing and jumps and a grandstand that can fit 2,000 spectators on one side, and on the other side a steep bank of quite spectacular hospitality tables. And then elsewhere in the hall, there's sort of all sorts of stands and exhibition stalls with luxury brands like Gucci and Longines, obviously, and art exhibitions and whatnot. And the key thing about this is it's designed to mix high-end sport, so they have the best of the best there. You know, the world's top 20. I think there are 40 or 50 competitors there. 100 or so athletes in total, with both humans and equine athletes. And it's the best of the best, top 20, Olympic champions, world champions, blah, blah, blah. And they compete in the various masters events. And then lower down, there are essentially invitational events. And by that means, they get big name or rich competitors to come along. And a few that were there and their attendant spectators that are drawn. A few that were there over in LA. Destry Spielberg, daughter of Steven. Mm. She was competing in one of the early rounds on the Friday. And she was leading, in fact. And this was my first taste of horse sport. Equestrian horse sport, and genuinely it was thrilling. I mean, the show was incredible. They mic up the jumps so that you can it blasted around the venue is the breath of the horse as it jumps over these 1.5 meter jumps or whatever, and whenever they clip them, there's a gigantic noise. It's genuinely quite thrilling. Anyway, Destry Spielberg, round she goes, clear round, spectacular. Steven and family cheering on. Me too, I'm captivated. And then, can she win it? This will be a good story. No, she can't, unfortunately. She was pipped at the last by none other than Eve Jobs. Eve Jobs, of course, unimaginatively named daughter of Steve Jobs. Quite amusingly, the gala dinner on the first night, I was talking to a barman. Here's a top tip for uninitiated people at sports events. Always talk to the barman about what the hell's going on. He was able to give me a good flavour of what I could anticipate. He was reeling off a list of names that he was expecting, including the likes of Steven Spielberg, Bill Gates, Leonardo DiCaprio, Bruce Springsteen. He also threw in Steve Jobs, and I thought, oh, that would be a turn up for the books. A PR coup. Nevertheless, Steve did not turn up, but Eve Jobs did take the win. And yeah, that was all very good. Anyway, these events, actually, as a matter of fact, I mentioned Bruce Springsteen there. Bruce Springsteen's daughter, Jessica, is in fact a world-class equestrian.
She's genuinely
very, very good.
Wasn't an invitational.
No, she's a ranker. She's a ranker. Top ranker, along with Georgina Bloomberg, daughter of Mayor Bloomberg. Mm. She was very good indeed as well. And they were all there. This event, so I spoke to various people who were involved behind the scenes. It turns out these events cost between $7 and $8 million to put on, and the majority of that is got back through sponsorship. Longines, the watch company, has a massive deal to cover all of the events. It's huge into equestrian sport in general. Anyway, Longines have a massive deal. They cover about 50% of the budget, along with the other sponsors, I might add. And this is essentially the jewel in the crown of their equestrian sponsorship portfolio, which includes a $100 million deal with the FEI, $100 million 9-year deal with the FEI, something like that. And it was genuinely an impressive event that mixed high-end sport with glitz and glamour.
Yeah, I have a question. You're in Southern California with this event. So why do you have it indoors?
It's probably too hot for both spectators and equine athletes together to have it outside. Also, there's a very specific setup that's needed. The other two Grand Slam events take place in Paris and in Hong Kong. Paris is actually taking place this week, early December, and then Hong Kong is in the early part of the year. And essentially, they take the template and just transpose it into another venue. So all they need is a convention center or a big indoor building of a similar size. And then they can create the atmosphere. They've got show lights, a very impressive suite of lights and dressing. It's an immaculate presentation. That's basically the reason. And each venue apparently, although I've only been to the LA one, has its own local flavor. So for example, but within the master plan that they transpose everywhere else. So with this LA one, for example, all the hospitality guests eat whilst the competition is going on at their tables. But I think that's the only one of the three where that happens. And that's because in American sporting culture, you know, you're used to eating a hot dog once you watch sport, whereas in Paris or Hong Kong, that would be considered a bit rude. Mm-hmm. So they have little changes like that. One of the interesting aspects that I found about it, not knowing a great deal about equestrian sport in general, was the lengths that they go to transport these horses. All these European horses have to be shipped over or flown over, and they use a specially equipped Emirates plane to bring them over from Belgium or Paris, I think. Transport them over the North Pole all the way down to LA. Their hooves don't touch the tarmac, all these forklift trucks involved in lifting them up onto the plane. They're not sedated in the 13-hour flight. They have a few grooms with them and to feed them throughout the flight. And one interesting element I found out was that on this flight, they have a special team of machinists with a special machine to hoover up the waste product from the horses, because a horse's urine is particularly corrosive, and that's obviously dangerous for the underbelly of a metal plane traveling 13 hours across the world. Just before we came out here to the Surrogate studio, I was on the phone to John Collins, the former chief operating officer of the National Hockey League. He just resigned last week, or announced his departure last week. This week, only today, he has announced that he's teaming up with George Pine, former IMG executive, former NASCAR and IMG executive, and he's going to be leading up George Pine's joint venture with Redbird Capital Partners and the NFL. That joint venture is called On Location Experiences, previously known as NFL On Location. It's essentially going to be offering travel and hospitality packages, the full shebang, consumer-focused full shebang, first of all to NFL events, NFL marquee events like the Super Bowl and the Pro Bowl and bits and pieces like that. John Collins, something of a superstar. He's got his, he's always had his fingers in all the icy pies at the NHL. He has he's widely lauded, and he's been held responsible for transforming the league from a $2.2 billion a year operation to a $4 billion a year operation. He was the man who signed the deal that Owen Connolly was talking about a few weeks ago, the $1 billion digital media rights partnership with Major League Baseball Advanced Media. Anyway, he's good, and here's the interview. Firstly, congratulations, one and all, on this move for John. My question to both of you, it's the same question, but put in different ways, I suppose. John, why on-location experiences? And George, why John?
Maybe I should wait to see what George says first, okay. But I guess I'll go first. So for me, and I've spent a lifetime in the sports and entertainment business, built a lot of value, you know, at the NFL and most recently at the NHL. And George and Jerry have a vision for really how to reimagine the entire hospitality business by putting the fan first. That's something that really appealed to me, the idea of being part of a startup company, essentially, with great partners, with great track records, a lot of capital behind them, like George and Jerry, but also the partnership that begins with the NFL and an iconic event experience like the Super Bowl, which I think we think and the NFL thinks can really be taken up to a new level, and can be the basis for a company that really diversifies across sports on a global stage, but also into the entertainment community, is something that was really important. And the last, or really appealing, the last piece that was important was, you know, the opportunity to be partners with George and Jerry in this venture, the opportunity to have a little skin in the game. Was something that after 25 years in a league environment was certainly appealing.
And from our end, I think when you look at... First of all, I think when you look at John's track record of results, what he accomplished at the NHL, the revenue that was generated, in addition to someone who's innovative and creative and has really a grasp of global sports, and somebody who has worked at the highest levels and led an organization, you know, I'm not sure he's one of the best sports executives, you know, out there. And so in terms of selecting a leader to lead a growth business, you really want someone who has a record of growth, a record of creativity, and a record of innovation. And I think those are the key elements, you know, for us. And then also, you know, as Jerry often says, you know, we're looking for the third leg of a stool in terms of a partner. And when we see John, we see a CEO, we see a leader, and we see a partner that can bring things to the table strategically that really sets himself apart from others. I think all of those elements really made an easy choice for us, and somebody that we're thrilled to be, you know, in business with. And I think when you look at the company now, as you begin to build things, you know, we have an equity partner with the National Football League. You know, we have hospitality rights to the number one sporting event in America and one of the premier sporting events in the world in terms of the Super Bowl, along with the other marquee events that the NFL has in terms of the international games, the Pro Bowl, the draft, and Hall of Fame. And we believe that we're putting in place the building blocks for a great company.
John, 2.2 billion revenues to 4 billion revenues, a 2.2 billion media rights deal with NBC, a 5.2 billion media rights deal with Rogers, a recent landmark agreement with MLBAM, $1 billion digital media rights partnership there, the Winter Classic, the list goes on. Did you feel that there were just simply no more milestones for you to reach at the NHL?
No, I think a lot of the things that we did, you know, we're building sort of the grand stage that I think hockey, you know, deserves. And it was really kind of the fundamental relationships that were being built out. So I definitely think as you look at, you know, the NHL's future, obviously its leadership under Gary Bettman, there's a lot of upside still there. You know, we were just getting ready, or we are launching, the NHL is launching the World Cup of Hockey in September of 2016, which promises to be maybe the greatest competitive hockey tournament ever. We had plans in place for other things internationally, a Ryder Cup style event, and obviously international games. There's the question of the Olympics and what we do there, but with the Winter Games being played in Beijing, I think in 26, you know, there's a real opportunity there to grow the sport on a global stage, which is something that I know the ownership is eager to do, and something that I know Gary has been very focused on.
What will your immediate priorities be at On Location Experiences? Are you building out a staff? What will you be doing on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I think for the first couple of days I'll be listening. But, I mean, it comes with the staff that was in place. This was a business that was operating at the NFL. And as George said, I think, you know, the NFL had an incredible respect for George's ability, frankly, as an operator. So that business has been operating out of his office. So I think we'll centralize it. I think we'll get focused on the NFL opportunity, which is the first major partnership in this new agreement. So, you know, what can we do around the Super Bowl? What can we do around the draft? What are we doing about the future international games, as George has kind of laid that out? And then I think, you know, it'll be about where are the opportunities. So, and I think there's a lot. I think this is a business that George and Jerry have identified that is ripe for innovation. It's a business that, frankly, hasn't put the fan at the center of it in the way that it really could or should or that will be able to do. And so I think, you know, we're only limited by our own creativity and work ethic, which, you know, one of the reasons why I came here is because, you know, George and Jerry are just incredible partners who have done things in the industry which have reimagined businesses. You know, Jerry will talk a lot about, you know, what he did with the Yes Network and what he did with Legends and how those businesses were reimagined. You know, George's vast experience both in changing the entire business at NASCAR, and then his vast global network at IMG, as president of IMG, I think, are resources that I'm really eager to tap into, and I think it'll be really fun and very collaborative, and I think ultimately be very successful.
George, maybe this one for you, given that John has obviously only recently just started. I understand that packages for Super Bowl 50, obviously your immediate priority, are almost fully sold out. John talked there about putting the fan first, and you know, you've spotted a gap in the market for sort of consumer-focused hospitality packages, I suppose. Could you give me an idea of what the actual level of progress is on the Super Bowl 50 sales, and why is this offering unique? What packages are you putting together that we've not seen before?
Well, I think, I'll give you two things. One thing I'd like to just add in on backing John is that when you, with Redbird Capital and with Bruin, you have again long-term capital that we want to deploy against, you know, businesses we think we can build. And so John has an opportunity to invest more capital. So when he comes to us with an idea to acquire a business or build a business or invest capital in a business, we're going to back him. And so I think when you look at what we have, is we have a great executive, a great leader, someone who's creative and innovative, and we're going to enable them to leverage that capability by backing them with capital to build businesses. So I think to me that's, you know, interesting and exciting. As I've said to John in many ways, it's very similar to what we're you know, what I'm doing at Bruin is very similar to what he's going to do at On Location. So I think that's another interesting look at what John, you know, has for future prospects.
You dropped a few hints there about the future direction that the business could go in, and I guess you're both hoping that John will lead you that way. Could you give me any more concrete idea of what opportunity markets you are looking at?
Yes, I mean, I think we've said from our very first announcement that sports is a global business, and so certainly we're not going to be restricted by geographic boundaries, and incredible experiences are not limited to sports. And so again, people always ask me what are we going to do, and what we want to be applying ourselves against is things that we think they have opportunities for growth and value creation for the fan and the consumer, and also for the rights holder or the federation. So, we don't have any specifics today other than to say that we have somebody that's a very talented sports executive with a track record of growing value, innovation, and creativity with an arsenal of capital behind him to build a business where there are opportunities in the marketplace to take advantage of them. And I think that's, the direction that we'll look to go. And again, there won't be any geographic restrictions on those opportunities.
That was John Collins and George Pine. Expect moves into different sports and different markets soon. Coming up in part three, it's the EuroLeague and social media in sport.
Sports Pro, the sports industry leader in print, digital, events, and podcasts.
Welcome back to part three. A fresh round of drinks on the table and a fresh round of thoughts in the head. Mike, first up, let's tap your thoughts on EuroLeague's big deal, revolutionary joint venture with IMG that's been announced recently. It's going to transform European basketball. Is this the UEFA Champions League moment for EuroLeague?
Potentially, although if FIBA has anything to do with it, possibly not. So I don't know how much you know about the background to this kind of infighting, this conflict going on in European basketball in the club game. It's kind of a club versus international governing body warring going on right now. Dates back to turn of the millennium in 2000 when the EuroLeague decided to break away from... The EuroLeague didn't exist then, but a number of the top clubs in Europe decided to break away from the control of FIBA. They were competing in a pan-continental competition run by the governing body. And they decided, strangely, unbelievably, FIBA didn't trademark the EuroLeague name. So the EuroLeague clubs, or these clubs, got together, created their new competition and just took the name. So the FIBA decided to stick with its plans. Its long-running plans. It had run the tournament, a pan-continental tournament for many years. Called it the Supro League, which was a terrible name. You could see that it was never going anywhere. Anyway, it lasted a year, and is now defunct. So for the last 15 years, Europe's top basketball teams have operated what is now known, or continues to be known, as the EuroLeague. They set up a commercial entity called EuroLeague Basketball, which is based in Barcelona, and they've effectively held the rights to this competition ever since. In that 15 years, according to official figures, EuroLeague was celebrating obviously its 15th anniversary earlier this year in Turkey, and invited members of the media, including myself, out to Turkey to celebrate this with them, and they published a load of figures to show how developed EuroLeague basketball has come, the European club game has become in the last 15 years.
Sorry, James. Did you bring a birthday present?
I didn't, actually. I was hoping to get one from them. I thought they were dishing out the gifts. I'm a journalist, James. We all know that we don't give things if we don't have to. So 15 years down the line, the European clubs have generally done a good job growing the game, growing their brands. If anyone listening is not too familiar with the European game, it's more of a cultural thing in Europe, but obviously most of the big basketball teams are tied into multi-sports clubs. So you've got Galatasaray, CSK Moscow, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Fenerbahce, Panathinaikos, you know, many big brands in their own right. And they've effectively been running the game as they wanted to. Mm. And then, over the years, FIBA, you can call it what you want, but it seems like they've grown a tad envious of the development of the game since they obviously lost control of it. And they basically want it back. And so to do this, they have made their own proposal, something called the Champions League of Basketball, and they want to try and entice the biggest clubs back. So they came up with a 16-team proposal. The EuroLeague currently has 24 teams. I think it's it just shows that the individual team brands in basketball in Europe are, they kind of carry the whole game. You know, the EuroLeague over the last 15 years, I think six teams have won it, and a further nine teams I think have got to the final four in the, you know, and that's in the whole of the last 15 years. So it's very much dominated by, you know, the Barcelona, Real Madrid, CSK Moscow, all those big names I just mentioned. So yeah, it is strange, but the FIBA wanted to entice these teams to its new competition. So 11 A licensed teams, currently the teams that hold the A licenses in the EuroLeague, and then they would offer a further place to four domestic champions of, I think, Lithuania, France, Germany, and Italy, and then there would be a small qualifying tournament for the remaining places. So that was their proposal. Anyway, so that was made possibly late October. Mm. Within a week, the EuroLeague and IMG announced this so-called revolutionary joint venture. It's going to run for 10 years. This is the initial agreement. It's got an option for another 10. The point is that EuroLeague and its clubs continue to control the league and govern it. And IMG effectively manages all the whole commercial operation. So they'll manage all the global media rights and marketing rights of the league. IMG is said to be stumping up 872 million euros over this 10-year period, which kind of breaks down as into a big portion of that will go to distribution for clubs. So currently, EuroLeague clubs are said to make between 12 and 15 million a year revenues from the EuroLeague. Under the new proposal, which will begin next year, they'll take home towards 40 million. FIBA was offering 30 million. So obviously there's obviously comes down to money. But the thing with IMG is they've stumped up a load of cash as well to invest in the product and improving the product on as it's shown on TV. Investment in the quality of the broadcast and the standards and how it's produced and presented in arena. And then there'll be a revenue sharing element to it on top in terms of, you know, how much they can make in sponsorship and broadcast rights over that 10-year period. So obviously, yeah, the league will be trimmed down from 24 to 16 teams. Now, one of the key things here is that by trimming that down, the EuroLeague and IMG are essentially saying there's a lot of kind of flab that can be cut off the current EuroLeague as it is. And, you know, as FIBA did, they're looking to entice, they have enticed the 11 A-licensed teams. So they will be, they'll form the basis, you know, the basis of the 16-team competition. And then there'll be a further three places for national domestic champions. It's unclear at the moment where they'll come from, but probably France, Germany, and Italy. And then the winner of the Euro Cup will compete. So the Euro Cup is the second tier, the kind of Europa League of basketball. And then there'll be a further small qualifying tournament to work out the remaining places. So the point with this is that it's become, or it's edging towards, a kind of closed league, you know, of the style of the North American leagues. A lot of teams are being shut out with this, so they're very unhappy. Obviously, this kind of proposal, counter-proposal, you know, FIBA's very unhappy with it. A number of the national federations aren't particularly keen on it, the ones, you know, for whom this concerns. So it'd be interesting to see where it goes.
couple of quick questions on this before we move on. Does it matter if FIBA come out and say we're not happy with this new organisation, obviously, because we had a proposal that was rejected and we don't sanction it? And two, second question to both of you, is this the moment that European basketball has its sort of Champions League or European Cup rugby style reshuffle and then kick on from it? I suppose it's yet to be determined whether the European rugby, the new Heineken Cup essentially, is going to be successful, but clearly the Champions League that came out of the European Cup has been very successful indeed. Are we at that point with basketball? Questions open to the floor.
In terms of FIBA sanctioning it, I believe they will do. I know from speaking to Jordi Bertomeu, who's chief executive of the EuroLeague, you know, he's still very keen to work with them. I'm sure they will still do. FIBA is obviously introducing new international windows from next year for the women's game and the following in 2017 for the men's game. So this obviously ties into them looking out for their own interests and wanting the best players to be competing in their competitions.
Yeah, I mean, with the sanctioning thing, it's interesting with FIBA and with the IIHF and organisations that are tied to the major US league sports, that they don't have the same threat. They're not carrying the same big stick that FIFA or UEFA or the ICC might be, of being able to say, all right, you can set up your whatever league you want, but your players don't get to play in our competitions because those competitions don't necessarily represent the elite of those sports.
As Jordi Bertomeu says, you know, it's very difficult to compare basketball to football, soccer, whatever you want to call it. Obviously, FIFA is a very wealthy organisation. It runs the World Cup. Everyone wants to play at it. In basketball, the NBA kind of runs the business, and everyone else has to pander to it, which is what what FIBA is doing with its international windows.
Yeah, exactly. And going on to the second point, I think, are they trying for a Champions League or are they trying for a European NBA? Because it does sound like the setup of it with these 11 A-licensed teams means there's going to be very, very little movement between them.
Yeah.
You know, the Champions League and the European Rugby Cup ultimately have strengthened at least the elite leagues in that setup, because you want to compete to make progress into the European competition. With these ones, it sounds like for all but a few, it's not going to make a hell of a lot of difference.
Okay. Right, let's move on. From basketball to social media. Owen Connolly, your cover story this month in this month's Sports Pro magazine is all about sport and social media. It's part of a two-part thing that we're doing at Sports Pro, data, digital and data. Mm. And we're currently working on another edition with a load of digital and data stuff. And another excellent cover story featuring a person looking at a screen with an image of Facebook visible in their iris. Mm. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's you mean the image or the feature?
Maybe let's start with the image and then hopefully link from that to the feature.
Well, the image is, I suppose, capturing the idea that all of us are now beholden to these social networks and so many of the things that we do, particularly the things that we enjoy doing and enjoy sharing. I think the thrust of the piece basically is social media has gone in 10 years from being a way of communicating, a way of advertising yourself on the internet, to being a way of moving media around, basically. And in the 21st century media industry, sport is an integral part of it, because it captures people, it engages people, and it's something that people want to spend their spare time doing, watching, talking about. Mm. The problem is that social media is not an industry that people have understood very well, not even the people who started it. I think it's very much one of those things where people do things because they can, and then they see what the effect of those innovations are further down the line. So we're only just now starting to see a picture emerging of how different people, different companies, different broadcasters, different teams working within sport will use social media.
Mm. Here's a little bit of off the cuff research. We are all, I imagine, are we all millennials? Do we fit into the millennial sure. category? What is a millennial?
Us.
Yeah, it's us.
Yeah.
Anyone between, what is it, 18 and 30 odd, you know.
Yeah, so we're just about on the, so we're a remarkably young company over here at Sports Pro. We're all in and around the 30 mark.
We're quite digital natives because we can remember not using the internet. That's where...
Anyway, we're young people who use digital media. Are we millennials? No, it doesn't matter, does it? But here's my question to both of you. In your... Not in your lives, but in the way that you consume sport. Obviously, we all watch a lot of sport, and we all talk to people about sport. What social media platforms do you use to either watch sport or communicate about sport?
Twitter. Twitter is the main one for me. You know, whether it's breaking news from FIFA headquarters or trying to see a vine of the latest Southampton Football Club goal. You know, I'll always go to Twitter first and foremost.
Yeah, I'd say Twitter as well. But I think that we are distinct from some other millennials in that we work in the media. And Twitter is a very popular platform for journalists to share things and to get breaking news because it is so immediate. Mm-hmm. I think the numbers are showing that Twitter is actually plateauing in terms of its user base. And Facebook is still exploding. It's up at 1.5 billion monthly users.
So are you saying that Twitter's a form of social media for the media?
It is a bit, yeah. I saw there was, yeah, I actually saw something on long-form social sharing platform, Medium, over the summer. I'm afraid I can't attribute it because I can't remember who wrote it. But the interesting point that was made is that Twitter's having a problem managing its culture at the moment, and that's to do with... you know, various things, abuse and all kinds of things that are incredibly difficult to control on an open platform. But one of the points that was made was that it's become a platform for specialists to, you know, encounter with other specialists, and journalists fall very much into that that purview. Obviously, it's ideal for sport because it is immediate, because you can share vines of goals, because you can check the score more efficiently than you can anywhere else. And because people can share articles on it very easily. But I think within the wider user base that it's not as cut and dried as that. And I think certainly Facebook's reach is going to make it possible for Facebook to do things that are much more exciting in the next 5 to 10 years.
Monetizing social media is obviously a big issue, not just in the sports industry, but you know, specifically as far as we're concerned in the sports industry, and I think where the big bucks are concerned, certainly people, it's very easy to make the link, you know, where does the big money come from in sport, and that's broadcast rights. So when do we get to a point where a social media player is paying big bucks for essentially broadcast media rights? And here's my question to both of you. I guess we are sort of seeing that now in China, with Sina Sports and, you know, Weibo and Weibo and things like that. And obviously we've had various YouTube, not I guess really social media, but we've had YouTube paying rights for things. We've had the first NFL broadcast on Yahoo, again, not really a social media platform, but an obvious OTT thing that you can integrate with social media easily. Are we on the verge, a common question, are we on the verge of an entity like Facebook or Twitter coughing up serious dollar for media rights anytime soon?
I think it's going to be a very long time before Twitter does, because Twitter at the moment remains a loss-making enterprise. Facebook possibly, although Facebook's appetite is very much for tech rather than media rights. I think Facebook think along the lines that people will come and use our platform anyway. The other point about Sina and Tencent, who are the big social media players in China, is that they do not have exclusive rights. They are digital partners, effectively, for properties that have some stuff on CCTV, and then it's just another means of accessing it.
It's a completely different business model, I suppose, in China. You know, you've got these companies that want to buy the rights, be the means for sharing those those rights and, you know, control consumption and distribution and, you know, from start to finish. Twitter and Facebook are just sharing platforms, quite simply. So I think they're quite happy remaining that way. I don't see them getting involved in, certainly not the you know, the top tier rights.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think about the numbers, and Facebook has a huge valuation. It's starting to make some pretty big profits, but you're still talking about the amount of money that you need to spend on media rights. Facebook would be happier going out and buying a startup that can completely transform the way people are using social media in 5 years' time. It makes more sense for them to do that than it does to try and attract or keep people on its platform in a way that perhaps doesn't make sense for its business model. I think probably we will start seeing tech companies get involved in rights at some time in the next decade, but it will be the big tech companies. It will be the Apples and the Googles and the people with, you know, enormous platforms and enormous revenues.
That is just about that. It just remains for me to thank Mr. Owen Connolly, editor of Sports Pro Magazine. Thank you very much, Owen.
Thank you very much, James.
And thank you to Michael Long, digital editor of Sports Pro Online platform. Thank you, Mike.
Cheers, James.